listening to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM with Padre Greedy and me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show about science, rationalism, atheism and the progressive left. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia or the arts, discussing subjects as diverse as conspiracy theories, cosmology, religion, human rights, philosophy and the state of the left. Our guest today is the journalist Paul Anderson. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Padre to introduce Paul.
Thank you. Paul Anderson is a journalist and writer. He started out as a journalist in the early 80s on the magazine of the European Nuclear Disarmament Group, END Journal. He then joined the Labour Left Weekly Tribune as reviews editor. He went on to head the Tribune in the early 90s before moving to the New Statesman as deputy editor. He left the Statesman when it was taken over by Geoffrey Robertson, co-wrote a book on the Labour Party with Niamh Mahon, Safety First, The Making of New Labour, then turned his hand to teaching journalism at City University, where he still works. He writes a regular column for Tribune, blogs at Gauche, and has just finished editing a collection of George Orwell's columns for Tribune, which comes out next month as Orwell and Tribune, published by Politico's. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Well, I suppose the first thing to start off with is, for the uninitiated, so to speak, what is Tribune and what was Orwell doing at Tribune?
Well, Tribune is a left-wing weekly newspaper, which was founded in 1937 by Stafford Cripps and various others. And, well, it's still very much alive. It's published every Friday. During World War II, it was edited by Niarran Bevan, later to become minister in the 1945-51 Labour government, in which role, of course, he was the founder of the National Health Service, subsequently was the leader of the Labour left during the 1950s. Orwell was a contributor to Tribune from 1940, a very occasional contributor, really, from 1940 to 1943, but was then appointed literary editor, a job that he did from 1943 to 45. In that role, he started a column, As I Please, which he wrote every week, then left Tribune to join The Observer as a war reporter, returned to Tribune as a regular columnist late 1945, although the columns that he wrote in 45-46 were not under the As I Please rubric, left again to go up to Jura, Scottish Island, where he was basically starting to write 1984, came back to Tribune and took up As I Please again, late 1946, which he did until early 1947, when again he left, went up to Jura and finished off 1984. He was the main bylined columnist in Tribune for most of the period 1943 to 1947.
Mm-hmm. So you've got a book coming out of George Orwell's collected columns. Is there a reason why you thought this was sort of a good time to release that?
Well, we've been talking about doing it for ages, and if I'd had time, I would have done it 10 years ago, but I didn't. The occasion that we're exploiting mercilessly, or shamelessly rather, is the 70th birthday of Tribune, which comes up in January 1937. There isn't really an Orwell anniversary. If we'd wanted an Orwell anniversary, we should have done it for 2003, which is the centenary of his birth. Unfortunately, this is as good an excuse as any.
But do you think there's the particular political climate is a good time to be releasing a book about Orwell?
Well, I think that Orwell's columns are they're a model of the columnist craft for starters. So there's always a good reason to be putting them together on those grounds. Obviously, quite a lot that he was writing about was very much time specific. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the politics of the mid to late 1940s, and anything that's written 60 or so years ago, journalism written 60 or so years ago, about events and books, many of which are long forgotten. A lot of that is not going to be of massive contemporary relevance, although I still think that it's worth reading because I think history matters.
Sure.
But it's amazing how well quite a lot of his journalism stands the test of time. It's not simply that his style is a model of clarity and so forth, in no sense archaic. It's also that a lot of the themes that are covered by Orwell are still as relevant as ever. I mean, the slipperiness of political language, racism, the threat of the atom bomb, etc., etc. All of these things are still very much live issues. On top of that, there are certain timeless topics that Orwell covered in the Tribune columns, which are in no obvious sense political. In a sense, they're all about the limits to politics, and that discussion is still one that I think is important and relevant. And what Orwell had to say about the impossibility of politicising Christmas, for example, or the delights of springtime, both of which he wrote about on more than one occasion. They still strike a chord.
Sure.
On that point, I mean, I've been reading back a lot of Orwell lately, and you do find, particularly in 1984, you find him protesting against the way that the party attempts to politicise absolutely every single aspect of people's lives. And obviously that's something that affected Orwell, and that Orwell was very strongly against. But do you think it was something that that Tribune broadly was against? I mean, the people setting up Tribune, they weren't entirely of a Marxist strand, were they?
What's interesting about Tribune is that it went through several changes of line, really, in its early years. It started initially as an attempt to secure a united front of the Labour Party, the Communist Party, and the Independent Labour Party, the main left wing parties in Britain at the time. And at that time, although I wouldn't describe it as being Marxist, it was extraordinarily uncritical of the Soviet Union. It ran a political line that was very, very close to the Communist parties and so forth.
Do you think that was through naivety or through purpose?
It was quite deliberate. It was the reason for it was that the Communist Party was an important part of the coalition. And essentially, an explicit agreement was made that no criticism would be allowed. Eventually, that fell to pieces because the Independent Labour Party basically fell out with the communists over Spain. So by 1937, the position of Tribune is basically that it's very much caught in the middle of this gigantic row on the left. What's bizarre about, 1938, it's caught in the middle of a gigantic row on the left. What happens bizarrely is that it actually becomes more pro-communist. In the very late 1930s, it's only 1940 after the Hitler-Stalin Pact and the Nazi invasion of Western Europe that essentially Bevan and various others seize control of the paper and put it into a position that would roughly be described as pro-war, democratic socialist pro-war, and broke definitively with the Communist Party, which at this time was arguing for a defeatist position. It considered that the Second World War between 1939 and 1941, when the Hitler-Stalin Pact was in operation, it considered the war to be an imperialist war. Mm-hmm. Bevan and Tribune broke with that in 1940, and it's at that point when a journalist called Raymond Postgate became editor, subsequently rather better known as the editor of the Good Food Guide. He became editor in 1940. The political line was changed into one very critical of the Communist Party, increasingly critical of the Soviet Union. Although, again, there are qualifications that need to be made about that, because from 1941, yeah, Soviet Union is an ally. Orwell was very much at the, when he was on the staff, very much at the most extremely critical kind of end of the Tribune spectrum. I mean, there were still people that wanted to hold back on criticism, particularly while the Russians were you know, in the forefront of the of the anti-Nazi war. I'd say that he's as much as anybody defines the Tribune line. I mean, it's a very, very small newspaper. We're talking it depends on which one you're looking at, but we're talking 12 to 24 pages. He's the big name that's in every single one. So although he's not writing the editorials, they're written by Bevan or by one of the other journalists on the paper. Orwell defines to a very large extent the position that the paper takes. And after the Second World War, you find the Democratic left in the Labour Party, its position diverges from that of the Communist Party even more. So in the late 40s, and this is really after Orwell leaves the paper, Tribune is at the forefront, really, of support for formation of NATO, is a pretty hardline cold warrior in its politics. So that's a long answer to the question. I'm sorry about that, but it is complicated. The shifts of political position the left ends up taking in this period are absolutely extraordinary, and I find it fascinating. But it is a bit like, you know, what's happened in recent times over the war on terror, the invasion of Afghanistan, invasion of Iraq, where again you're looking at serious turmoil with friends falling out and what have you.
Well, I was going to ask you to bring Tribune up to the sort of the history of Tribune up to today, basically, because the line. It's certainly anti-war, isn't it? It's lying at the moment, I would say.
Well, yes, it has been. I think that in a sense is entirely consistent. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the 40s, the hardline Cold Warrior Tribune lasts only until the Korean War, and from Korea onwards, Tribune, which is at this point very much still Bevanite in its affiliation. It's against British participation in the Korean War. It then opposes German rearmament in the early 1950s. It's very much against the Suez Adventure in 1956. Plays a major role as a supporter of the campaign for nuclear disarmament in the late 50s and early 60s. I mean, it used to be known as the official newspaper of CND to critics who thought that it was far too soft on the CND leadership. Then, against the Vietnam War, took a similar role in the 1980s peace movement, very much in favour of unilateral nuclear disarmament, and it was a supporter of the European nuclear disarmament campaign, which I was involved with in the early 80s, taking a non-aligned. It was critical of Soviet nuclear arms as well as NATO nuclear arms, taking a non-aligned position. It has been consistently nuclear pacifist. It's been consistently against what it sees as imperial adventures by Western powers. Its position on the war against terror, Afghanistan, Iraq, has been very much supportive of a stop the war kind of position. Mm-hmm. Although it has also run very critical material on the organisation that, well, leads the anti-war movement, sure. The Stop the War Coalition. So that's roughly where it is.
And going back to Orwell specifically and his, to put it mildly, suspicion of the Soviet Union, could that be traced back? I mean, are we looking at his experiences in the Spanish Civil War as forming that idea, or are we looking even before that?
Well, I think Spain is absolutely critical there. Before the Spanish Civil War, although you see in Road to Wigan Pier, for example, Orwell is he's rude about the Communist Party and sceptical about the idea of taking your ideas about foreign policy from Moscow and so forth. It's only really the direct experience of, essentially the Stalinist suppression of the revolutionary left in Catalonia.
Maybe it's worth explaining that, explaining Orwell's role in the Spanish War.
Indeed, okay, well... This is a complicated one, but to start at the very beginning, Spanish Civil War breaks out as a result of a nationalist coup led by General Franco, which is initially unsuccessful in most of Spain, and the response to it essentially is that the left parties and the left trade unions, the biggest of which in Catalonia anyway is anarchist, the CNT, they essentially arm the workers and. The armed workers essentially suppress the coup. There then follows an invasion of mainland Spain from Morocco by the nationalist forces led by Franco, which is resisted, and essentially this becomes a cause célèbre for the entire left throughout Europe. And in late 1936. Essentially, the Soviet Union and the Communist Party decide to start recruiting volunteers for an international brigade. Orwell independently decides to go over to Spain, but rather than signing up with the international brigade, he joins the militia of a small far left group, the PUM. It's denounced as Trotskyist, but it isn't actually a Trotskyist. They're the sister party of the Independent Labour Party in the UK. So he joins the ILP contingent in Spain and is sent to the front and so forth. Anyway. To cut a long story short, and I've already gone on rather too long about it, but the situation essentially is that in 1936, as a result essentially of the armed uprising of the workers, there's a social revolution in Catalonia and a number of other parts of Spain. Where power is essentially held by, the working class organised into its trade unions, and that social revolution is supported by the anarchists and by the PUM. So we're looking at things like, socialisation of industry and of agriculture and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, the communist position is... at this point, that the revolution is a diversion from the military struggle against the nationalist uprising, and that essentially all of this should be put on the back burner, property should be restored to its rightful owners and all the rest of it. The idea behind this being, essentially a popular front of the working class and of the Republican bourgeoisie, if you like. Sorry, this is all terrible jargon, but can't get away from it. This creates a gigantic crisis, to simplify ridiculously. In May 1937, the government led by the communists decides to essentially to suppress the radical anarchists and the PUM in Barcelona. There's then well the PUM and the anarchists put up barricades, and Orwell finds himself almost by accident fighting on the side of the PUM against this attempted well, it's an attempted coup really. Now that doesn't actually succeed at first. The whole thing there's a compromise reached and whatever. But a couple of months later, the Stalinist secret police, and essentially here we're looking at it's led by the Soviet secret police. They have they control the secret police in Spain. Bizarre as it might sound, essentially go about arresting and killing the leaders of the revolutionary left. And Orwell escapes from Spain with his name and his wife Eileen's name on a wanted list as confirmed Trotskyists. And what would have happened to them if they'd been caught? We don't know. But anyway, that experience, and particularly, well, that direct experience, and then afterwards, and this was particularly important, Orwell's experience of the failure of the left in Britain to tell the truth about what had happened in Spain, the suppression of the PUM and whatever. Most famously, the editor of The New Statesman, Kingsley Martin, refused to run Orwell's reports on the May events and their aftermath. But Orwell's disgust at this willingness to lie, or essentially to cover up the truth, lay behind, well, that led him to a distrust, which is to put it very mildly, of Soviet communism, Stalinism, that was to last to the end of his days. And of course, you know, that informs Animal Farm and 1984.
Right, yeah. Okay. Now, getting back to the PUM, which you say, I mean, wasn't essentially Trotskyist, but probably had Trotskyist elements. And again, looking at the character of Emmanuel Goldstein in 1984, do you think Orwell may have had certain sympathies towards Trotskyism, or was he driven to that position by his rejection of Stalinism?
I think this is an interesting question. There's no doubt that he took Trotskyist ideas about the nature of the Soviet Union very seriously. The idea that the Soviet Union was a degenerate worker state, that the revolution had been betrayed, is absolutely central to Animal Farm, for example. Yeah. In 1984, Goldstein is, to a certain extent, obviously based on Trotsky, although the analysis in Goldstein's book, The Theory of Oligarchical Collectivism, I think it's called. Yeah.
This is Theory and Practice of Oligarchical
Collectivism. Well, there we go. I'm sorry. I'm quoting from memory. But it's actually far more based on the writings of an American former Trotskyist, James Burnham, The Managerial Revolution, his most famous book. With whom Orwell, I wouldn't say was obsessed, but who Orwell read very, very thoroughly, and obviously plays a massive role in developing Orwell's ideas about the nature of Soviet communism, which is not to say that he was uncritical, it was anything but. So there's very definitely, you know, Trotskyist influences on Orwell's thinking, if, you know, one step or several steps are removed. It would be wrong, however, to describe him as a Trotskyist, and he never, as far as I'm aware, endorsed a Trotskyist program. And he was certainly very sceptical about the idea that had Trotsky won the internal battles in the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in the 1920s, that things would necessarily have turned out better. So my feeling is, in fact, that he's rather closer in his politics if we want to look at Marxist contemporaries, to Victor Serge and various, I suppose, libertarian Marxists who might have gone through Trotskyism but came out the other side at some point during the 1940s. And another very important figure, and I mean, Serge Orwell corresponded with, he tried to get his Memoirs of a Revolutionist published in the UK. But another a really important figure is Dwight MacDonald, the the American well, writer and critic, who in the 40s, having been an Orthodox Trotskyist in the 1930s, in the 1940s moved out of Trotskyism into a more libertarian pacifist position in MacDonald's case, but published a journal called Politics, to which Orwell contributed, and which Orwell plugged shamelessly in his Tribune columns.
Could you perhaps just outline some of the ideas behind the idea of libertarian Marxism as opposed to Marxism?
Well, yes, is the answer to that question. The big idea, I suppose, and I'm necessarily talking here in a broad brush terms. The idea behind what I'd call libertarian Marxism would be essentially that it's a Marxism that rejects the dictatorship of a political party, believes in self-organisation of the workers rather than their direction by a vanguard political party.
So we're saying all hope lies in the proles, essentially.
Well, all hope lies in the proles, yes. And I think that's something that is at the core of Orwell's beliefs, almost to his dying day. Although that said, I also think that he becomes very pessimistic in the course of the 1940s about the possibility of the revolution that he so desired and which he thought was rather likely to take place in 1940. You look at The Lion and the Unicorn, his famous essay on British politics at the start of the Second World War. There's one author, John Neusinger, who's described the position in that as revolutionary patriotism. It's a very, very accurate description of Orwell's politics at the time. Now, by 1945, he's no longer got the faith that this is going to happen, and although my suspicion is that he would rather like it to have happened, he's pretty much, you know, sort of an Orthodox Labour Party supporter. He goes out canvassing for Labour in the 1945 general election, and between 1945 and his last political writings, he's broadly supportive of the Labour government, although he's also critical. He doesn't feel that it's moving fast enough, he's also very critical it's not concerned with civil liberties in the way that it ought to be. So he allies himself with anarchists on questions of free speech and so forth.
Okay, we'll pause for a quick record here. This is Black Cat by Broadcast.
Are you fine?
Welcome back. You're listening to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM. That was Broadcast Black Cat from their The Tender Buttons album. I'm Neil Denny and I'm with Padre Greedy here, and we're talking to the journalist Paul Anderson.
Hello. Paul, we've been talking about Orwell and Orwell's work in Tribune, and but obviously most people know him from particularly from 1984 and Animal Farm. And we've a tendency with those two books, but maybe more broadly again, to view Orwell as, to use a horrible, horrible phrase, a secular prophet who was predicting all these things. And we always say, you know, the phrase Orwellian has slipped into usage. Do you think Orwell himself had any notion of writing for the future, or was he really stuck in his own specific time and place?
Well, I think there's obviously an element of a prediction, or at least, well, guesswork about the future in 1984. I mean, it is about a future, in a sense. It wouldn't, I don't think, have been called 1984 if that hadn't been the case. However, my own feeling is that it's best to look at 1984 much more as a satire on the contemporary world, in particular, a satire on totalitarianism.
But it's even more obviously about Soviet, more so than Nazism.
Absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely, with the focus particularly on Stalin's Russia, which incidentally he had never visited. and obviously Animal Farm is an allegorical tale about the Russian Revolution, although obviously, again, it has wider implications it's about revolutions in general, in a sense, as well. What's interesting here is that Orwell, in the Tribune columns, is extraordinarily sceptical about any sort of a political prediction. He's constantly ribbing so-called experts for having got things terribly wrong in the previous 4 or 5 years. He also is amazingly honest about when he's got things things wrong, and he laughs at himself for having been so stupid as to think, you know, revolution was on the cards in 1940 or whatever. There's even one column that goes under the went under the headline "Old George's Almanac," which is a sort of semi-serious attempt to predict the year ahead for the New Year issue. I think it's the New Year issue of 1947. I could be wrong about that. It might be 1946. So in a sense, I find it very difficult to read 1984 as a book about where things are going. It's much more, I think, a contemporary satire that uses an imaginary future world as a means of commenting on the here and now. But, you know, I mean, that's not to say that I'm necessarily right. That's an interpretation.
But Padraig's just described Orwell, or described other people describing Orwell as a secular prophet, and that's a good humanist way of describing what I mentioned to him earlier as Orwell being the patron saint of the left, which obviously is a description he wouldn't have liked himself. And his writings and his ideas are often fought over by the left, by people of various strands of the left, and there's arguments that go on about, you know, where he stood on issues. But I've also read people on the right trying to claim Orwell for their own as well. And I wonder if what do you think of this? Is there an ambiguity in Orwell's writing that could allow for this, or is it just wishful thinking, do you think?
Well, I think there is an ambiguity in Orwell's writing, and there are certain things that he has to say that are undoubtedly attractive to certain tendencies on the right. I don't particularly object to anybody appropriating whatever they want of any writer for their own purposes. I think this is one of the things that happens in life.
But Orwell seems particular. This happens to Orwell particularly, I think, more than most writers.
That's I agree with you there. I think that's absolutely true. I think my own feeling is that what's important in a sense is that historically there is no way in which he was a man of the right. Throughout his throughout his life as a writer, which is essentially all we really know about. He's very definitely of the left, and it shows in terms of everything that he says, all of his political affiliations and so forth. So I think that the attempt of the right to appropriate Orwell to claim that he wasn't really a left winger or whatever is utter nonsense. But at the same time, there are certainly elements in Orwell's thinking that are very attractive to right-wing libertarians and to very mainstream liberals.
And there's also his background. He was an old Etonian. He was in the colonial service in Burma.
Yeah, but also a lifelong anti-imperialist. Mm-hmm. So, going back to his first known writings on imperialism. Mm-hmm. So. I don't think it's worth having a gigantic scrap over the Orwell inheritance, if you like. But I do think it's important to establish where he was actually coming from and where he saw himself historically. Yeah. I think it's incontrovertible that he is a figure of the left.
I've always felt, and something that may be appealing to, well, English conservatives at the very least, is there's, despite his internationalism, there's quite a sense of Englishness about his writing, and particularly maybe, I mean, it pops up always, but I remember the first time I read Coming Up for Air, and I was quite a bit younger, and I actually stopped after that because I found it so terribly English, and I could see how that didn't square with the kind of language of international socialism for me at all. This kind of nostalgia for bread, beer and bacon didn't quite
and
fit.
And there's also the famous where he's dismissive of the sandal-wearing vegetarians and that sort of side of the left as well.
Yeah, I mean, he argues that there are certain things, well, beer, bacon and, well, what have you, that are beyond politics, and frankly, there is no shame in being proud of these particular, peculiar English traditions. However, there are other things about England that he detests. So, you know, the Empire, the Tories, and it's difficult to know where to start and where to stop. He's in no sense someone that embraces everything about England. Mm-hmm. He's somebody who likes certain things about it. I'm absolutely at ease with that, and I don't really see that there's a major problem with it. Although I do see how it could jar with anybody who, you know, doesn't feel the same way. This one will run and run, because there's undoubtedly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's there in the Tribune columns as well when he's writing for a consciously left wing readership, the glorification of the English spring, of the peculiar wildlife to be found in these aisles and so forth. Absolutely, it's there. It's a current all the way through.
Well, let's get back and talk about some of the actual writing that's going to be appearing in the book. And you talked about some of the themes that Orwell was keen on back in the 40s. And one of the ones that stood out for me when you mentioned it was the slipperiness of political language. And Padraig's already used the term earlier in the interview, Orwellian, which has become something of a cliche, really, to describe sort of almost like dystopian futures. And the idea of newspeak, obviously, from 1984, he was obviously very concerned about that in 1984. And we do see this sort of thing happening. So in that one instance, perhaps he was something of a prophet.
Well, yes, certainly. I mean, I think that the concern with the English language, politics and the English language, very famous essay, not one that appeared in a Tribune, although the themes of it recur. Again, this comes back to the experience of Spain, and the particular bugbear, if you like, is the use of jargon by Marxist parties, particularly Communist Party, and one of the Tribune pieces is a rather funny but excoriating assault on some communist tract that has obviously been translated from rather literally from the Russian, which is full of lackeys of imperialism and running dogs of this, that, and the other. But that cliched political language, I think again you do need to situate it very much in its time. I mean, there are obviously people running around doing very much the same thing in the cause of militant Islam, or in the causes of militant leftism of one kind and another today. But Orwell's, I mean, so yes, it's a timeless concern, or it's a concern of, you know, the 21st centuries. But I do think it's important to situate it particularly in the quite extraordinary excesses of Stalinist political language of the 30s and 40s, which I don't know, I've ended up reading rather more of it than is, you know, good for the sanity. But it is really, really quite extraordinary in its excess. And well, what Orwell has to say about it is very, very, it's absolutely pertinent, and in a sense bizarre that, lots of other people weren't saying the same thing.
Do you think, I mean, that kind of dislike of jargon ties into what I sometimes feel with Orwell is an actual dislike of ideology? And I was reading the Lost Orwell, which is Peter Davison's new collection, or recent collection, and there's one very funny letter from Eileen, his wife, to her friend Nora, in which she mentions that they bought a dog and called it Marx to remind them that neither of them actually read much Marx. You sometimes get this idea that he wasn't really particularly enthusiastic about really solid ideology. He preferred the vagueness in some sense. Do you think that's true?
I'm not sure about preferring vagueness. I think the thing that that he objects to is its construction of models of how the world works, mm-hmm. A priori, that can't be questioned from within. I suppose it's the totalitarian mindset. I don't think that that's necessarily anti-ideological as such. It's much more a scepticism about closed systems of thought, a commitment to empiricism, to mm-hmm. the facts.
Yeah.
Which, you know, in certain respects, terribly English and all the rest of it, but also something that, as a journalist, I admire greatly. But he's not hostile to ideology in the sense of being against socialism, let's say, or democracy, So in terms of values, I think he's open to ideas. He dislikes the closed mindset that goes with orthodox Marxism, let's say, or with fascism. Or with ideological commitment to the free market. So you know, he's got very little time for Hayek, for example. Although he admits that or accepts that Hayek's critique of socialism has a certain validity to it. I mean, there's something of a magpie in him, but I think that the fundamental democratic socialism is there pretty much through his writing life.
Just something I wanted to ask about is perhaps a sort of an Orwell controversy. It was alluded to in a speech given by the Honourable Member for Bethnal Green and Bow, George Galloway, that Orwell might have been working for British intelligence at one point, and this alludes to a letter sent to his friend Celia Cohen. Would you like to explain this?
This one has been going for rather a long time. Now, the question as to whether or not Orwell was working for British intelligence, this one has been rumoured for ages and ages. Now, all there is circumstantial evidence that frankly doesn't add up to a great deal. We also need to look at the circumstances in which, you know, he is alleged to have worked for a British intelligence. And it's not actually related to the Celia Kerwin incident. It's actually earlier when he goes over to Europe. As a correspondent for The Observer, where he stays in a hotel that was essentially used by British intelligence, and he meets various people who are working for British intelligence. Now, remember, however, that we are talking about total war at this point, and working for British intelligence is something that I think I would have been rather proud to have done. And it, not something I think that anyone would have ended up associating with skullduggery or acting in some way that is a betrayal of leftist principle. So that's the British intelligence connection there. Now, the Celia Kerwin story. What happened was this. Orwell, with Julian Simons, who's a friend, another journalist and critic, and a great thriller writer, but that's another story, they were spotting Stalinist apologists as a sort of game that they were playing, you know, sort of over a pint or whatever. And Orwell kept a note of the people that he thought were pushing a pro-Soviet line, yeah, for his own amusement and
just
use.
Time-wise here, this would have been about...
We're talking 46, 47. Yeah. Yeah. So it's the point at which the Cold War is beginning to beginning to kick in. At least as far as I'm aware, I don't think it dates to anything any earlier than that. So it's the Cold War's beginning to kick in, and Orwell is thinking, right, okay, who is it that's sort of plugging the Soviet line? And yeah, there's this long list that he kept at home and was not intended for publication or anything like that. Now, subsequently, what happens is that the Labour government decides to, in the face of this Soviet propaganda blitz, to set up a unit in the Foreign Office, the Information Research Department, that was essentially going to end up putting out propaganda for, well, democracy and democratic socialism, broadly speaking. And one of the people that it hired was Celia Kerwin, who was, well, a good friend of Orwell, and possibly a former girlfriend. Certainly, it appears that he made a pass at her, but he made a pass at quite a few people. Anyway, that's as many people. Anyway, she asks him for advice on who should not be asked to write for this Foreign Office propaganda outfit, and he supplies this list of names that is culled from, well, it's basically taken from his own notebook, okay? And that's what has appeared in the recent, the last couple of years. The Guardian published it, and then Peter Davison's latest volume prints it in full again. Now, the point of this is, well, it's not a blacklist. It's a list of people that if you want to produce anti-Soviet propaganda, you don't ask. And it seems to me that that's no crime. I think, well, I don't know. It's the sort of thing that... that journalists do informally all the time. Mm. If we want someone to write something or other, then do we want to get to X or Y? I'm not going to get into names. And the response would be, no way. He's a central committee member of the Communist Party of Britain. You know what he's going to say. That's the way that commissioning takes place. Now, okay, this is slightly more formal than that, but frankly, big deal. I mean, I don't, it certainly doesn't show that he was a narc.
But people such as Scott Lucas and more recently Galloway have made this into Orwell's massive betrayal. I mean, you debated Scott Lucas quite virulently.
Indeed. On your blog, well, I think they're wrong, and I don't think that there's any evidence to support their thesis. And it's part of essentially. It's part of an attempt by people who are, well, either explicitly or implicitly sympathetic to or actually Stalinist justify their own politics. It's got nothing whatsoever to do with Orwell's the reality of Orwell's life. Although, of course, he was a militant anti-Stalinist, which they don't like.
So we're sort of running out of time, but if you tell us, when is the book actually coming out?
Well, it's coming out next month. I think the date we're looking at is the 25th of September. Mm-hmm. So end of the month, and it will be available from all good bookshops.
And it's published by Politico.
Politico's, yeah, mm-hmm. An imprint of Methwin.
With a foreword by Michael Foot.
Yep, that's right.
And you write a really good blog. So, what can you give us the blog address?
I've completely forgotten it. It's Google Gauche, GAUCHE, and it comes up.
It's libs.blogspot.com.
Thank you.
It's my journalistic mind working.
Hey, and our website is www.littleatoms.com, where you'll be able to download this interview in a few days. So we should just thank Paul for thank you very much for coming on Little Atoms, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.